famous last words of the Apostle Paul are recorded for us in the book of 2 Timothy. In that passage, Paul is describing for Timothy, his perhaps closest associate in ministry, one he has mentored now in many ways, looks upon as a peer. Timothy, no longer dependent on Paul's instruction, but now thoroughly capable of teaching, preaching, and ministering on his own. Paul writes to him and expresses to him his heart. He gives him advice. He gives him words of encouragement. He gives him words of strength. He continues to be the teacher. He returns to the mentor. He does some of that on an ongoing basis, but he does it in a very specific way in 2 Timothy. But knowing that he's about to die, knowing that his time is brief on earth indeed, Paul now draws the attention down in a very personal way. You've heard pastors or teachers or others who say, almost as an aside, this is not from the professional part of it, this is something that I want to share from my heart. And so I've entitled this last portion of chapter 4 to the close of the book on a more personal note. Now, as Paul comes to a more personal note, we need to think in those terms. We need to understand from the perspective of that context. Realize that when he shares these thoughts and these words, he's going to bring people into play. Others who have been a part of his life and who will continue to be until his death. And he's going to share some of his heart that reveals the fragility of life itself, especially in the face of death. It reveals some of the uncertainties, that reveals some of the issues. It kind of melts away everything that doesn't matter, and it leaves only in the crucible that which is of the purest form. Paul speaks to Timothy in that way. This is what he would have said. If Paul had been dying of an illness and still had his mind about him, and Timothy had been standing next to his bed, this is what he would have said to him. If he's in prison and in shackles and unable to secure his own freedom and knows that as Nero's persecution of believers increases, that Paul is going to be a primary target and likely he will be taken out and publicly beheaded, Paul says these words to him. So it's personal. It should be taken as such, and it should be understood in that context. In 2 Timothy 4, in verse 9, it says, "Do your best to come to me soon. Do your best to come to me soon." He wants Timothy to understand, "I want to see you." This is not the first time he said it. He said it a number of times, in fact, but now he says it with a sense of urgency. He adds to it, "Come to me soon," because he knows that he doesn't have a later. Now, Timothy is in Ephesus. Ephesus is a 3 or 4 month journey to Rome where Paul is imprisoned. And so he knows that in order for him to come, he'll have to leave soon. He also knows that it's important that he travel before the weather would change, because the trip would be even more treacherous during the wintertime. And he'll make that point later on. But the point of this is, I want to see you. We need to be together. I need to be encouraged by your presence. That gives us understanding of what the apostle was going through. It gives us a certain personal touch to this man that we think of as the great apostle, the one who has written, two-thirds of the New Testament, and has recorded so much of God's Word, who has taken Christianity from the confines of Judea and has now spread it throughout the known world and has begun a ministry of evangelism, outreach, missions, and ministry unlike anything the world had ever seen before and unlike anything the world has ever seen since. What we see now is the personal side. We see the individual Paul, come to me soon. What we learn from that is we all need each other. Isn't it interesting when you get to the end of life, you don't want to count your money. You don't want to thumb through the titles of your possessions. You don't want to remember your conquests and achievements. You're not going to look at the pictures of places that you've been to. But you're going to draw together with family, with friends, the closest relationships. In fact, that's all that matters. Sometimes we put our relationships in such jeopardy for foolish reasons that simply don't matter. And the day will come when all of that will melt away and all of that will be gone, and we will face the uncertainty of the world that is before us and the reality of the end of a life that cannot live on in this form. And then we will have to come to some conclusion about what matters most. If it matters most in that moment, should it not matter more today? I think so. What have we invested ourselves into? What have we given ourselves to? And what is it that we have sacrificed and forfeited in the process? Paul says, do your best to come to me soon. And he reveals to all of us the importance of the relationships that God has given to us. In verse 10, he says, Demas, in love with this present world, has deserted me and gone to Thessalonica. Crescens has gone to Galatia, and Titus has gone to Dalmatia. Here he gives us insight into three other associates. The first of them is Demas. Now, Demas was a believer, and Demas was a fellow minister. Demas probably came from Thessalonica. Paul probably met him, led him to the Lord, and God called Demas into ministry while he was there. Demas then follows Paul in a portion, at least, of his missionary journey, and he ends up with him in Rome. So it's likely that he was there when Paul was imprisoned the first time in Rome, and it's likely that he has been with him up to this point, but now he leaves. Paul isn't happy about his departure because Demas evidently gave him reason to believe that the reason he was leaving was because he didn't like it here anymore and was afraid. When he says he's in love with this world, he's simply making a reference to the fact that Demas was more concerned with convenience and comfort and the absence of a threat on his life than he was with doing what God had called him to do. It is apparent that Paul felt Demas was sacrificing his ministry. He was sacrificing his calling in order to return to something else. And so he says he's in love with this world. Certainly that could be interpreted a number of different ways, and you could understand it to be love of the world as being love of material things, or it could be just the loving your life as it is in this day and age. Either way, it doesn't make that much difference. The point is the same. If we love the world, we're not going to be willing to commit to the call. You see how difficult it is to do both? Jesus said we cannot serve two masters in reference to money and God. We'll love one and hate the other or vice versa. It's simply not possible to do both. Here, the Apostle Paul seems to echo that same statement when he refers to Demas and his departure from Rome. He says he is in love with the world, so he's gone back to Thessalonica. Maybe he's gone back to a business. Maybe he's gone back to a place of authority. Maybe he's gone back to a place of safety or comfort. I don't really know, and the Bible doesn't exactly say, but the bottom line is that he has sacrificed his calling in order to pursue his comfort. Sound familiar? I think a lot of us fall into that category, and even from time to time, all of us find ourselves in love with this present world and enamored and captivated by the things of this earth, rather than filled and overwhelmed and drawn and called and obedient to the things of God. So that Paul would describe Demas and his departure as a desertion. He has deserted me and gone to Thessalonica. Now, Crescens and Titus, obviously Titus we know a little bit about, but Crescens we know nothing about. And I don't think his name appears anywhere else. And so we really don't know anything about him at all. But we do know about Titus, and it is likely that these two were sent by Paul. So they didn't desert. They're not to be associated with Demas and what he had done. Crescens and Titus have returned to places of ministry. Most likely, Paul instructed them to do so. He doesn't say that here, and he does occasionally mention that. But it is likely that that's what has happened. And we know from other biblical texts and records and even some historical documents that that was certainly true of Titus. So we have what can only be described in verse 10 as a contrast between Demas and then Crescens and Titus and the commitments that they have. You see, on the one hand, a commitment that was short-lived and that faltered because he had never really dealt with his love of the world. And on the other hand, you see two who had stayed faithful and loyal to the ministry that God had called them to, but now, even though Paul needed someone with him, it is agreed upon by these three that the ministry needs them more. So Crescens and Titus return to their ministry. It'll always be that way for all of us. There are always going to be those who are going to be in love with the world and tied to it and so attached to it that there's just simply no breaking apart, there's no coming away, and there's no commitment. And then there are going to be those who are going to not only follow what God calls them to do, but I can only imagine that as difficult as it would have been to stay with Paul, it would have been equally difficult to leave Paul in the situation that he was in. But the higher calling demanded it, and so they left. In verse 11, he says, "Luke alone is with me. Get Mark and bring him with you, for he is very useful to me for ministry." Now, Luke, you know. Luke wrote, of course, the Gospel of Luke. He was a physician by historical account and record. He was a disciple with Jesus throughout his ministry here. Luke then was the chronicler of the expansion, development, and expansion of the church. So the book of Acts is written by Luke. Luke is someone that doesn't often appear in the record or the text, and yet was present or may have in fact recorded it and kept up with it. If you read Luke's gospel, you find it to be very orderly, and so that's why it is used as one of the primary sources to understand the historical part of Jesus' life and ministry. Luke had been faithful to Paul and had stayed with him. Luke may have penned some of the letters that Paul sent because Paul's eyes were failing and his health was poor. But he would have written almost as a scribe for Paul. Either way, he's still there. I wonder when he read these words or if he was privy to this letter, if Luke thought, "So what am I, chopped liver? Luke alone is with me. It's all I got. Somebody help me out here. You know, I'm dying on the vine here. I've got Luke, and he's just not enough." You know, no, it wasn't that way, but I can see, well, at least if your brain's a little bit twisted, you read stuff like that. When I read that, I thought, "Luke alone is with me." I hope Luke didn't take offense to that, you know, and I don't think he did, and that's certainly not what is intended. He's just making a statement. Luke alone is with me, but he's already said to Timothy, "You come as soon as you can. And when you do, I've only got Luke here with me. I need some help, and you're going to need some help. So bring Mark too." Now, you remember Mark. We've also seen Mark in the Bible in numerous places. But in the book of Acts, Mark had become a believer, and he was a follower, and he had gone on a missionary journey with Paul and with Barnabas. Had been sent by the church in Antioch, and on their way, Mark gets homesick. Now, we don't really know why he wants to leave, but we just know that Mark wants to leave. And he becomes so adamant about it that they finally just let him go. And Mark leaves and returns home Well, Paul doesn't want any more to do with him. He's not trustworthy at that point. So when they get ready to do the next missionary journey, Mark wants to go again. And Paul says, no way, you're not going with us. Last time you went with us, we get halfway through. We're depending on you. You've got a job and a responsibility. And then you take off crying to mama. You're not going with us. Barnabas says, Paul, you need to calm down. You know, he was young then. He's learned. He's grown. He'll be okay. Let him come. He says, no, he's not going with us. There's no way. And Paul evidently was a very my way or the highway kind of guy. And so Mark wasn't going to get a second chance. Well, maybe you know the story. Paul and Barnabas decided that they would each take different companions. And rather than going together, they would split into two groups. Cover twice the ground, Mark would go with Barnabas, and Paul would take others. And that's what happened. Along the way, Paul reconciled with Mark, saw the value of what God was doing through his life and his ministry, and Mark became a trusted friend and companion to the point where Paul would say in this passage, "Bring him with you. He is very useful to me for ministry." I think the way that latter part should be interpreted is has less to do with Paul doing a ministry and incorporating Mark's abilities into it. I think it had more to do with Mark was useful to him personally. That when Mark ministered to Paul, that it was something that strengthened him and that encouraged him. And so I think it was a very personal statement. So in the same sentence, even though there are people that aren't together at this point, he said, Luke is with me, and he speaks of the loyalty, and he speaks of the consistency, and he speaks of the fact that it's almost assumed, well, you know Luke, he's still with me. Nothing's going to shake him up. Nothing's going to move him aside. Nothing's going to keep him from following what God has called him to do. Luke is with me. It doesn't matter if they're threatening me, if they're going to kill me, if they've imprisoned me. Makes no difference. He's still with me. Get Mark and bring him with you too, because we got a lot to do and a little bit of time to get it done. And so as knowing the background and the history of Mark, we see how God has restored that relationship. What does it say? Well, it says that in a person's life, we're going to have all kinds of relationships. We're going to have some that aren't going to hang in. They're going to leave. Probably for the wrong reasons, for selfish reasons, for self-centered reasons, for reasons that Paul describes as being in love with the world. Have some that are going to continue faithfully to serve and go as they are sent, even if it requires a painful separation. We have some that are going to stay and keep doing what they've done day in and day out, no matter what. They're going to be faithful and consistent and dependable to the point that we're going to take them for granted. And then we're going to have others with specialized skills and giftedness that God is going to call out and use in all of these different areas. What you're seeing here in a very microcosmic way is a picture of the church. Even though these people that Paul is describing are not the church, they are certainly a part of it. They were leaders. What you're seeing is a small version of the way the church is supposed to work. Different gifts, different abilities, different strengths, different circumstances and backgrounds, and all of it coming together. Some of them kind of filtering out and going their own way and doing their own thing. Others of them being sent out in a very specific way. Others doing those day in and day out tasks that are so almost mundane and yet so vital and so important to the ministry. I think about all the ministries of our church, and one of the things that we've been doing lately is talking about it a little more so that people have a better understanding. And we're going to do more of that. We're going to help you to understand more about some of the ministries that are ongoing in our church. But I had a lady from another town call, and she said that their church was trying to do some ministry to people in their community that don't have financial resources. Maybe need help with a bill or with a utility or maybe, something of that nature, or they need food or whatever. She said, we were thinking about starting a food pantry, but there's already one of those in our town and didn't really want to duplicate that. And she said, we were thinking about doing a clothing closet, but that's difficult to maintain and it's hard to to kind of manage, and so we weren't sure that was the best choice either. And so then we heard that you have a system at your church that you're doing that is primarily based on financial support, and she said, I was wondering if you'd share it with me. Well, we do. We have a program called MRT, and it's one of the more popular ministries that we have, and yet it involves the fewest number of people in the church. It's primarily run by one church member plus staff, and of the staff, 99.9% of that is done by Marilyn and Marianne. So when I say staff, I don't really mean me or Craig or Bradley. I mean those two. But people come in, and this week, in fact, was a barrage. I mean, it was almost overwhelming. Marilyn and Marianne spent an entire day, and I mean literally an entire day, doing very little else other than interviewing and helping and providing for members of our community in a specific way. Well, this person called and said, how did you set that up, and what does it involve, and how much do you give out? So I told her what we budgeted, and I forget what it is. It's, you know, it's, I don't know, $7,000 to $9,000 a year we budget for MRT. And I said, she said, well, how much do you give out? And I said, oh, somewhere around anywhere from $23,000 to $30,000 a year. She said, well, how do you give that much money away if you only budget, you know, $7,000, $8,000, $9,000? I said, I don't know. I really don't. She said, well, what do you mean? I said, well, it just never runs out. And she said, I don't understand. How can it not run out? You know, you're going to have to be $25,000 in debt there, or at least your budget's going to blow out at the end of the year. How is it that it doesn't? I said, I'm telling you, I don't know. People put money back in. What people? I don't know what people. I don't keep up with that. Church people? Other people? I said, it comes from all kinds of odd sources. We never know where it's coming from. But I said, every time we get down to the point where we're ready to say, well, if someone comes in tomorrow, we're going to have to tell them no funds available, then money comes in. We get checks in the mail. Somebody comes by and says, hey, I've got some extra money. I wanted to give it to the church. Is there a particular need? Well, MRT's kind of down. Okay, we'll give it to that, you know, and here's $1,000. That happens all the time. I can't explain that other than I think it's God honoring that ministry. People don't know about that. And yet some people do. Somehow the information had filtered down to this woman in a church in a neighboring town that I don't even know and have no affiliation with. They had heard about Temple Baptist Church and a program that they were doing there to help people in their community. Now, I'm not advertising the program because it gets enough advertisement by mouth now, but I am suggesting to you to understand that when you give your tithe and when you give your money and when you do these kinds of things, you are a part of something that is much larger and that reaches much further into the community than you could have possibly known. And that's the way it's supposed to be. The church is supposed to function with all kinds of gifts, all kinds of skills, all kinds of different things, all of them working together to accomplish a singular purpose. Paul says, bring Mark with you. We're going to need him. And then he says in verse 12, Tychicus, I have sent to Ephesus. And Tychicus, we know, is a part of the ministry and has been for a while. We've seen him a number of times. And so he is probably going to be the one to take this letter. 2 Timothy is probably going to be delivered by Tychicus to Ephesus. And then he will probably take over the ministry while Timothy returns to Rome to see Paul. Tychicus probably was the one who delivered the letter to the Ephesians. So when you read the book of Ephesians in your Bible, that's a letter that was written to the church in Ephesus. Paul wrote that letter while he was away at another time and probably during his first imprisonment, and it was Tychicus who delivered it and probably read it to the people for the first time. So he was well known in Ephesus and someone that would have been a part of Paul's ministry for some time. So he said, I am about to send him to Ephesus. And then in verse 13, it says, when you come, bring the cloak that I left with Carpus at Troas, also the books and above all the parchments. It is unclear to us exactly what it is that he wants him to bring as far as the content. Books, they didn't really have books like this. It would have been scrolls. And that probably referred to copies of the Old Testament that Paul had that he had left there with him. Parchments would have been a much more expensive material that they wrote on, and it would have been pages, probably made from animal skins, and could have been bound into books. But the way it's described here, it's likely that it would have been writing materials. And so Paul was asking him to bring some writing materials that he would be able to record things on that would have longevity. The scrolls would have been something he would have read. Again, we don't have any way of knowing what was on these particular documents. We just know that he wanted them. Obviously, Paul didn't travel with his library, but obviously he had something of a library, and Timothy knew where it was. And so he said, bring that to me. He said, also bring the cloak I left with Carpus at Troas. You see, he knew that in order for Timothy to go from Ephesus to Rome, he had to go through Troas. And so Carpus was a friend, someone he had left his cloak, cloak being a single-piece garment with a hole in the middle of it, kind of like a poncho. Obvious reasons he needed that. He's in a dank, dark prison cell, and he needs to be warm, and probably the weather's changing. He says, bring me my cloak. And so you're going by the house anyway. You'll probably spend the night there with Carpus. I left it with him, and he's holding it for me. And so he's going to bring him his cloak. He's going to bring him the books and the parchments. Now, what's the point of all that? Well, the point is it shows us something of the route that he's going to take, and it gives us some understanding of the way that they moved about in the known world. But the other thing is it humanizes the Apostle Paul. It shows him to be like us. You know, if you're going to be away for a time, what do you need? Well, you need a good book to read. If you're going to, you're going to be confined in a small spot, you need something to write with because you like writing letters. It gives you a way of communicating. It would be the same thing as you saying, bring my laptop. It's the same thing. If you're going by Carpus house in Troas, get my cloak. It's cold here, and bring my laptop. Because I didn't bring it with me. I didn't think I was going to be here that long. The Apostle Paul helps us to understand what he's going through, but we see it through eyes that are very much like our own. In verse 14, he says, Alexander the coppersmith did me great harm, and the Lord will repay him according to his deeds. Why does he warn him about Alexander? Well, again, from other texts, we know Alexander lived in Troas. Timothy has to travel through Troas in order to meet up with Carpus, in order to get the cloak, and to come on his way. I mean, that's pretty much the only way he could travel. Alexander's made it clear that any Christians coming into his community are going to face difficulty, perhaps imprisonment. Alexander didn't have the authority to arrest Paul, but he did incite a riot that resulted in Paul being stoned and driven out of the city and almost killed. Alexander was most likely a Jew, and he was someone who hated Christians. Now, he wasn't a Jew in the sense that he was just born Jewish, but rather he was probably of Jewish leadership. So maybe something like a Pharisee or Sadducee, the same people who opposed Jesus, the same people who opposed what Christ was doing in his earthly ministry, this would have been part of that. And Alexander, evidently, according to the Apostle Paul, was quite good at it. And he warns him about him and says, he did great harm to me. Be on guard. Be on watch for him. But know this, he's not your problem. God will deal with him. Now, there is a sense almost of vengeance in his voice, but there's also a sense of relinquishment. He is not going after him, nor is he encouraging anyone else to do so. Alexander is someone to be avoided. If he doesn't want what we have to offer, we'll keep doing what God has faithfully called us to do. God's going to deal with those who oppose the truth. And that's what he said. And I think that's what he wanted him to understand, but there's no question that he is concerned about him, and he says, beware of him. Verse 15, beware of him yourself. He strongly opposed our message. And we know that he did all these other things that I mentioned as far as persecuting the apostle and trying to get in the way of what he was doing. But it brings us down to kind of a concluding thought. He opposed our message. The Apostle Paul is sitting in a prison awaiting the judgment of the emperor, knowing that when it comes, it probably will result in his death. He has very little time, maybe months, that are left to him. He understands the system. He knows what the delays are all about, and it's going to take a while for this to happen, but it's a short while. He takes into account the time that it would take for Timothy to travel from one place to another. He's able to calculate that out, determine that there is sufficient time for him to get there. All of it is simply designed to accomplish the greatest amount of the mission that God has given him in the time that he has remaining. Paul is not sitting here stewing. He's not crying. He's not whining. He's not quitting. He is continuing to do what God has called him to do. He's just doing it now through other people. Instead of doing it himself, he's letting other people be his voice, be his feet, be his eyes, be his hands. Paul is taking what God has put inside of his heart, and he is expressing it into the lives of others in a way that they will not be able to contain, but it will get out. He's writing letters to churches. He's writing letters to individuals. He's giving instructions. He's having meetings. He's doing everything he can with the time that he has left to make the most of what God has given him to ensure the greatest amount of people hear the gospel possible. What is it that drives us? What is it that motivates us? What is it that causes us to do what God has called us to do? Or what is it that wakes us up in the morning, gets us up in the day, and gets us going on the way? Most of the time, it's what I want, it's what I need, it's what I have to do, it's what I want someone else to do, or what I want to see happen in the world. Most of it is self-centered. Most of it is me-oriented. But for the Apostle Paul, he was oriented to the things of God, the will of God, the way of God, the power of God. It was God-centered. You see how death doesn't interfere with that? Do you see how personal comfort and convenience isn't really a factor in that? Do you see how those things sort of fall away and you gain a perspective that you just couldn't possibly have apart from that? That doesn't mean that Paul didn't get angry or frustrated or he didn't face those times of depression and difficulty. It doesn't mean he didn't have those feelings or he wasn't upset. It just means that those things were not going to rule him. Those things were not going to control him. Those things were not going to be dominant in him. He kept his eyes fixed on the gospel. I'm overwhelmed when I read things like this and I put myself in a position. I have an imaginative mind, and it's one of the reasons that I like books of fantasy and fiction. I can travel to places in my mind that I can't go with my body. I like movies like that, and that's why. It allows me to escape. But when I read something like this, the downside of having an imaginative mind is you can imagine what it would be like to sit in prison. The downside of having an imaginative mind is you can imagine what it feels like to lose a loved one or a child. The downside of having that imaginative ability to project yourself into situations and feel the emotion of that moment is that you got to be kind of careful with it. And every once in a while detach from it or it'll hurt you. When studying this passage, I could imagine myself sitting in prison with the shackles on my feet and my hands. I could imagine what it smelled like, what it looked like, what it felt like. I could feel the humidity and I could feel the heat and I could feel the roughness of the stone floor, the grit and the dirt underneath your feet or your hands. I could smell the odor of bodies that haven't ever been washed since they've been put into that prison. And how it emanates up and down through that, and the fact that there would be no sanitary system of any sort. You can imagine what the food would taste like. perhaps a crust of bread that nobody else wanted, meaning that it was stale or hard or worse. I can imagine the fact that there would have been no protein to eat and very little water to drink. And I thought to myself, if I were sitting there and I was in that situation and I felt what he felt, would my first thought be of the gospel? Or would it be of me? God, I've done all of this for you. I've been beaten. I've been stoned. I've been rejected. My family won't speak to me. The people I grew up with, the friends that I had, and all that I went to school with, they don't want anything to do with me. They hate me. And even my fellow Christians, they didn't trust me. And now here I am in prison. I've persevered. I've written what you told me to write. I've done what you told me to do. And this is the thanks I get. You see, the problem is, for those who think that way, they think that having it easy in this life or comfortable is God's way of thanking you. But it isn't. The greatest thanks that you can get from the Father comes not from ease. It comes from obedience. I cannot help but believe that the moment Jesus uttered the words, "It is finished," that in that moment, he believed with every fiber of human existence that he had adopted that he had the full and complete support of God. I have to believe that when the Apostle Paul was led out onto the highway leading into the city of Rome, and there his head was removed, that the moment before the axe fell, that he believed. In that moment, he had a greater sense of the gratitude of the Father for his obedience than at any other. It all comes down to how you think and what you want. Is your life centered around you, or is it centered around Christ? Is it about what makes you comfortable and convenient, or is it about what brings honor and glory to God, regardless of the cost? When you look at this from the perspective of a very personal note, you have to come to the conclusion that what matters most is what God wants.